Chapter 36. Lauren was driving when they reached San Felipe. Pitt had stretched out in the back seat and was snoring away, but she did not bother to wake him. She guided the dusty, bug-splattered Pierce Arrow around the town's traffic circle, making a wide turn so she didn't run one side of the trailer over the curb, and turned south toward the town's breakwater-enclosed harbor. She did not expect to see such a proliferation of hotels and restaurants. The once sleepy fishing village was riding the crest of a tourist boom. Resorts appeared to be under construction up and down the beaches. 5 kilometers, 3 miles, south of town, she turned left on a road leading toward the waters of the Gulf. Lauren thought it strange that an artificial, man-made harbor had been constructed on such an exposed piece of shoreline. She thought a more practical site would have been under the shelter of Macharo Point, several kilometers to the north. Oh well, she decided. What did gringos know about Baja politics? Lauren stopped the Pierce alongside an antiquated ferry boat that looked like a ghost from a scrapyard. The impression was heightened by the low tide that had left the ferry's hull tipped drunkenly on an angle with its keel sunk into the harbor bottom silt. "Rise and shine, big boy," she said, reaching over the seat and shaking Pitt. He blinked and peered curiously through the side window at the old boat. "I must have entered a time warp, or I've fallen into the twilight zone. Which is it?"
"Neither. You're at the harbor in San Felipe, and you're looking at your home for the next 2 weeks."
"Good Lord," Pitt mumbled in amazement. "An honest-to-God steamboat with a walking beam engine and side paddle wheels. I must admit it does have an air of Mark Twain about it." "What do you want to bet it ferried Grant's troops across the Mississippi to Vicksburg?" Gunn and Giordino spotted them and waved. They walked across a gangplank to the dock as Pitt and Lauren climbed from the car and stood gazing at the boat. "Have a good trip?" asked Gunn.
"Except for Dirk snoring, it was marvelous," said Lauren.
Pitt looked at her indignantly. "I don't snore." She rolled her eyes toward the heavens.
"I have tendonitis in my elbow from poking you."
"What do you think of our work platform?" asked Giordino, gesturing grandly at the ferry boat.
"What do you think of our work platform?" asked Giordino, gesturing grandly at the ferry boat. "Built in 1923. She was one of the last walking beam steamboats to be built." Pitt lifted his sunglasses and studied the antique vessel. "When seen from a distance, most ships tend to look smaller than they actually are. Only up close do they appear huge. This was true of the passenger-slash-car ferries of the first half of the century. In her heyday, the 70-meter, 230-foot vessel could carry 500 passengers and 60 automobiles. The long black hull was topped with a two-story white superstructure, whose upper deck mounted one large smokestack and 2 pilot houses, one on each end. Like most car ferries, she could be loaded and offloaded from either bow or stern, depending on the direction the ferry was steaming at the time. Even when new, she would never have been called glamorous, but she had supplied an important and unforgettable service in the lives of millions of her former passengers. The name painted across the center of the superstructure that housed the paddle wheels identified her as the Alhambra. "Where did you steal that derelict?" asked Pitt. "From a maritime museum?" "To know her is to love her," said Giordino without feeling. "She was the only vessel I could find quickly that could land a helicopter," Gunn explained. "Besides, I kept Sandecker happy by obtaining her on the cheap." Lauren smiled. "At least this is one relic you can't get in your transportation collection." Pitt pointed to the walking beam mounted above the high A-frame that tilted up and down. One end driven by a connecting rod from the steam cylinder, the other driving the crank that turned the paddle wheel. I can't believe her boilers are still fired by coal. They were converted to oil 50 years ago, said Gunn. The engines are still in remarkable shape. Her cruising speed is 20 miles an hour. Don't you mean knots or kilometers? Said Lauren. Ferryboat speeds are measured in miles, answered Gunn knowledgeably.
Doesn't look like she's going anywhere, said Pitt.
Not unless you dig her keel out of the muck.
She'll be floating like a cork by midnight, Gunn assured him. The tide runs 4 to 5 meters in this section of the gulf. Though he made a show of disapproval, Pitt already felt great affection toward the old ferry. It was love at first sight. Antique automobiles, aircraft, or boats, anything mechanical that came from the past, fascinated him. Born too late, he often complained. Born 80 years too late.
And the crew?
An engineer with one assistant and 2 deckhands.
Gunn paused and gave a wide boyish smile.
I get to man the helm while you and Al cavort around the gulf in your flying machine.
Speaking of the helicopter, where have you hidden it?
Inside the auto deck, replied Gunn. Makes it convenient to service it without worrying about the weather.
We push it out onto the loading deck for flight operations.
Pitt looked at Giordino.
Have you planned a daily search pattern?
The stocky Italian shook his head. I worked out the fuel range and flight times, but left the search pattern for you.
What sort of time frame are we looking at?
Should be able to cover the area in 3 days.
Before I forget, said Gunn, the Admiral wants you to contact him first thing in the morning. There's an iridium phone in the forward pilot house.
Why not call him now? Asked Pitt.
Gunn looked at his watch.
We're 3 hours behind the East Coast. About now he's sitting in the Kennedy Center watching a play.
Excuse me, interrupted Lauren. May I ask a few questions?
The men paused and stared at her. Pitt bowed.
You have the floor, Congresswoman.
The first is, where do you plan to park the Pierce Arrow?
It doesn't look safe enough around here to leave a $100,000 classic car sitting unattended on a fishing dock.
Gunn looked surprised that she should ask.
Didn't Dirk tell you?
The Pierce and the trailer come on board the ferry. There's acres of room inside.
Is there a bath and shower?
As a matter of fact, there are 4 ladies' restrooms on the upper passenger deck and a shower in the crew's quarters.
No standing in line for the putty. I like that.
Pitt laughed.
You don't even have to unpack. Make believe you're on a Carnival Line's cruise ship, said Giordino humorously.
And your final question? Inquired Gunn.
I'm starved, she announced regally. When do we eat?
In autumn, the Baja sun has a peculiar radiance, spilling down through a sky of strange, brilliant blue-white. This day, there wasn't a cloud to be seen from horizon to horizon. One of the most arid lands in the world, the Baja Peninsula protects the Sea of Cortez from the heavy swells that roll in from the dim reaches of the Pacific Ocean. Tropical storms with high winds are not unknown during the summer months, but near the end of October, the prevailing winds turn east to west and generally spare the Gulf from high, choppy swells. With the Pierce Arrow and its travel trailer safely tied down on the cavernous auto deck, Gunn at the wheel in the pilot house, and Lauren stretched on a lounge chair in a bikini, the ferry moved out of the breakwater harbor and made a wide turn to the south. The old boat presented an impressive sight as black smoke rose from her stack and her paddle wheels pounded the water. The walking beam, shaped like a flattened diamond, rocked up and down, transmitting the power from the engine's huge piston to the shaft that cranked the paddle wheels. There was a rhythm to its motion, almost hypnotic if you stared at it long enough. While Giardino made a pre-flight inspection of the helicopter and topped off the fuel tank, Pitt was briefed on the latest developments by Sandecker in Washington over the Motorola Iridium satellite phone. Not until an hour later, as the ferry steamed off Point Australia, did Pitt switch off the phone and descend to the improvised flight pad on the open forward deck of the ferry. As soon as Pitt was strapped in his seat, Giardino lifted the turquoise Numa craft off the ferry and set a parallel course along the coastline.
"What did the old boy have to say before we left the Alhambra?" asked Giardino, as he leveled the chopper off at 800 meters, 2,600 feet. "Did Jaeger turn up any new clues?"
Pitt was sitting in the co-pilot seat and acting as navigator.
Jaeger had no startling revelations. The only information he could add was that he believes the statue of the demon sits directly over the entrance to the passageway leading to the treasure cavern.
"What about the mysterious river?"
"He's still in the dark on that one."
"And Sandecker?"
"The latest news is that we've been blindsided. Customs and the FBI dropped in out of the blue and informed him that a gang of art thieves is also on the trail of Huascar's treasure. He warned us to keep a sharp eye out for them."
"We have competition?"
"A family that oversees a worldwide empire dealing in stolen and forged works of art."
"What do they call themselves?" asked Giardino.
"Zolar International."
Giardino looked blank for a moment, and then he laughed uncontrollably.
"What's so hilarious?"
"Zolar," Giardino choked out. "I remember a dumb kid in the eighth grade who did a corny magician act at school assemblies. He called himself the Great Zolar."
"From what Sandecker told me," said Pitt, "the guy who heads the organization is nowhere close to dumb. Government agents estimate his annual illicit take in excess of $80 million. A tidy sum when you consider the IRS is shut out of the profits."
"Okay, so he isn't the nerdy kid I knew in school.
How close do the feds think Zolar is to the treasure?"
"They think he has better directions than we do."
"I'm willing to bet my Thanksgiving turkey we find the site first."
"Either way, you'd lose."
Giardino turned and looked at him.
"Care to let your old buddy in on the rationale?"
"If we hit the jackpot ahead of them, we're supposed to fade into the landscape and let them scoop up the loot."
"Give it up?" Giardino was incredulous.
"Those are the orders," said Pitt, resentment written in his eyes.
"But why?" demanded Giardino.
"What great wisdom does our benevolent government see in making criminals rich?"
"So customs and the FBI can trail and trap them into an indictment and eventual conviction for some pretty heavy crimes."
"I can't say this sort of justice appeals to me. Will the taxpayers be notified of the windfall?"
"Probably not. Any more than they were told about the Spanish gold the army removed from Victorio Peak in New Mexico after it was discovered by a group of civilians in the 1930s.
"We live in a sordid, unrelenting world," Giardino observed poetically.
Pitt motioned toward the rising sun.
"Come around on an approximate heading of 110 degrees.
Giardino took note of the eastern heading.
"Do you want to check out the other side of the gulf on the first run?"
"Only 4 islands have the geological features similar to what we're looking for. But you know I like launching the search on the outer perimeters of our grid and then working back toward the more promising targets."
Giardino grinned.
"Any sane man would begin in the center."
"Didn't you know?" Pitt came back.
"The village idiot has all the fun."